Good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. Hopefully in this evening's show we'll have a little bit of consideration of the Ministry of Justice's recent decision to scrap the Administrative Justice and Tribunals panel, which I've been looking into, having been keyed off on it a little earlier in the week, and it makes pretty interesting reading, given what's happening with the benefits system and various other appeals systems throughout. From about 7 o'clock, I hope to have Simon Spaniard on for a live Skype chat.
But I'll come back. I'll cover it again. It's no problem.
Yeah, brilliant. That's absolutely great. It's quite interesting, isn't it, that the lower part of the organisation was quite interested in investigating what it is that you'd sent them to investigate, and then it got stopped at a given point.
Well, they didn't even want to investigate. This is the funny thing. So, you know, you're telling an official receiver who's claiming that there's no assets in the estate, and you're saying, well, there's loads of assets over there, and he's basically come up with, well, I don't think that there's anything there, so we won't bother even looking.
Okay. I think that we've got Freeman Jack telling us that we're back online again. I'll keep an eye on the chat box. Oh, yeah, it's okay. It looks like they can hear us all again now.
Right, okay.
Here we go. One more time. Live internet radio. I love it. It always brings me out in cold sweat. So here we go, Simon. Off you go, matey.
Right, okay. So I'll cover this off for those that where we got lost in the airwaves. I'll just cover this off. But very simply, I've been spending a lot of time now really revisiting everything that we know about credit agreements. And, you know, we've all been positive that these are promissory notes and so on and so forth. And so I kind of, and we all do this when we're going through our research and when we're experiencing various interactions, we go round and round, almost like a spiral, and we come back to information that we've come across before. But of course, as we've picked up new knowledge and new information, we can then look at it with slightly different eyes and from a slightly different perspective. And this is where I'm now coming from. Very simply, when you actually look at the relationship of obtaining, let's say, a personal loan or a credit card, what you're basically doing, let's say you phone up a company and phone up a bank, for argument's sake, let's say it's Barclays Bank. You phone up Barclays Bank and you inquire about a loan facility. They go do all their checks and then they agree figure work with you. Now, at the point that they actually agree the figure work with you, that is the agreement. All right? That is the agreement. Now, in order to actually be a little bit more assured that you mean business and that you want to go ahead with this credit agreement, they will then send you out a document to be signed and returned. Now, we always think of that as being the credit agreement or the loan document, all right? But in actual fact, according to the Consumer Credit Act 1974, Section 189, that document, which is a note, is classed as a security. And the reason that they ask for that security, even though it's an alleged unsecured loan, is that that provides them with some kind of assurance that you are going to carry out the obligations of that agreement. In other words, that you're going to pay them back their digital currency. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, in revisiting, as I say, a number of different definitions, I then went to, and I think you covered it off earlier, but I'll cover this again. I then went to Stroud's Judicial Dictionary. Okay. Now, this was the fourth edition, 1974, and it's published by Sweet and Maxwell, which are the same publishers of the White Book. And so if anyone goes into court, you'll often see the opposing barrister or the judge sitting there with the most recent edition, hopefully, of the White Book. Now, within that Stroud Judicial Dictionary, promissory note is defined as any document or writing containing a promise to pay any sum of money. And anyone that cares to look at the White Rabbit YouTube channel will see that there's a presentation up there which repeats all of these definitions. Okay.
Yeah, I've put the link in there for people earlier on.
Brilliant. So we know from Stroud's Judicial Dictionary that anything which contains a promise to pay any sum of money is a promissory note. And in Barron's fifth edition law dictionary, it actually states that a promissory note is anything that actually expresses a promise or an agreement to pay any sum of money. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. Now, that defines a promissory note. So the credit agreement is without doubt, it's undeniable as far as I'm concerned, that is a promise to pay, that is a promissory note, and according to Lord Denning, in Fielding and Platt Limited versus Salim Najjar, 1969, he confirms that a promissory note is to be treated as cash, and that's for accounting purposes. So looking back at that, at the actual interaction between us and the bank, we make the verbal agreement to pay back, I don't know, £300 a month for a 10 grand loan, all right? They send out a piece of paper in order for us to sign that and return it so that they become more assured of our intentions to fulfill those obligations. However, that document is required by them in order to sponsor the credit. In other words, to create the credit. Because the moment that they receive that, let's say, £10,000 loan document through, that is entered into the bank's books as cash. And that will then create a debit and a credit entry.
And that cash was created by your signature on the form?
Absolutely. The promise to pay on the piece of paper, you know, I could make you a promise verbally, and my honour and integrity would dictate that I hopefully see that through. But in order for the bank, because, I mean, and I know what this was like, as a bank employee, we used to speak to hundreds of people, and a lot of people, as we would term it, blew out. They didn't go ahead with the loan. So in order to be assured, as a banker, that a customer is going to go ahead, I would send them a document. They put their paw print on that document, they send it back, and then I now know that they are serious about doing it.
So you saying that there was a time when we didn't have to do the loan document?
Well, I mean, if you're having a gentleman's agreement way back when, I've got no doubt that, you know, I mean, for example, you know, you might lend your friends some money. You know, I might lend a mate down the pub 20 quid. And out of honour and as out of friendship and out of trust, I expect them to pay me back. Yeah. But when you're dealing with an institution who doesn't really know you, albeit the fact that they check you out, according to the Consumer Credit Act, that document is a security. Even though they call it an unsecured loan, it's unsecured. It's unsecured in as much as it's not allegedly secured against a building like your home, and it's not secured against a vehicle or a car. And so their only security, their only kind of assuredness that you mean business
is
the piece of paper, which is treated as cash. Nice. And so when you deposit that back with the bank, or you send that back to the bank, the bank now has a £10,000 banknote. It enters that into its accounts. Obviously, the staff don't know this. The general staff don't know this. I didn't know this at the time. You set that up on the computer system. That's going to create entries. Again, front-end staff don't see all the entries. All they see is a single screen, and it comes up with the details of the loan facility, what the payments are, what the interest is, what the term is, who the customer is, and it sets up a record on their system so that they can actually disperse the check or the funds, and they can then start chasing you or making sure that you pay your payments. Yeah. That's all they see, right? Yeah. The other entries are hidden. But we know from double entry accounting that for every credit, there must be a debit. For every debit, there must be a credit. So when you're returning that document back to the bank, they enter that into their system, you are automatically in credit. It is the exact same process as if you were paying £10,000 into your current account or savings account. The account is the account. It has a debit side and a credit side.
Is that true of mortgages as well then?
Exactly the same. And I can touch on mortgages in later on. But in essence, the credit entry is your credit entry. So we automatically have a situation where, according to their rules, okay, and if we look at their rules for a moment, the OFT, the Office of Fair Trading, they regulate, and this is according to the Consumer Credit Act, sections 1-7, they regulate the unsecured loan marketplace. Okay?
Yeah.
The FSA, which is going to be changing in April, they're splitting into two different bodies, but the FSA, that's the Financial Services Authority, that regulates mortgage products, secured loan products, i.e. second mortgages, investment business and insurance business. But both the FSA and the OFT have a key principle when it comes down to the marketing of any product to a customer. Under the FSA, it's Principle 7 of treating customers fairly. And under the OFT, it's just one of their guiding principles, which is backed up by, and if I find it here, it's actually backed up by, I think it's the Consumer Credit Act. Consumer Credit Advertisements Regulations 2004, and it basically goes as follows. It's short, it's sweet, it's really simple, it's common sense, and it says any presentation to a customer must be clear, fair, and not misleading. Mm-hmm. Okay? Nice. Now, that covers off mortgage business, and it also covers off any unsecured loan business. Insurance business, investment business. It's got to be clear, fair, and not misleading. Now, if it doesn't comply with that, it's just breached the rules. It's breached the OFT's principles. It's breached the FSA's principles. It's breached the Consumer Credit Advertisements Regulations 2004. That, in turn, obviously is an attachment to the Consumer Credit Act 1974. And in essence, what we then have is a situation where if we're going to either lose or if they're going to gain, then we then have the Fraud Act 2006, sections 1 to 5, comes into play, which is fraud by false representation. And that carries, anyone found guilty of that, that carries a 10-year jail term.
And yeah, these people have been doing this for a long time, as anybody...
doing it for many years, man. knowing, and this is the thing, I got to thinking, and I thought, well, okay, look, you know, we've all been kind of dancing around different jurisdictions. We've been playing the game as a man. We've been playing the game as the person, as a trust, as a this, as a that, or the other. And I got to thinking, no matter what jurisdiction you operate in, okay, there are questions which have answers where the answers are always going to be the same. I'll give you an example. In common law jurisdiction, the answer to 2 plus 2 is 4. In equity, the answer to 2 plus 2 is 4. In natural law, the answer to 2 plus 2 is 4. All right? In statute, the answer to 2 plus 2 is 4. Therefore, when we're... I got to thinking that, well, when we're approaching these companies and we're approaching the regulator or whoever it is, where does it explain clearly and in a not misleading fashion that the document I am signing is a promissory note which is classed and defined as a security by the Consumer Credit Act 1974, section 189, and that that document is negotiable because Strouch Judicial Dictionary, 5th edition, 1986, clearly states that under the definition of negotiable, if it doesn't say it's not negotiable, then it is negotiable, pure and simple. So we have a negotiable instrument, which is a security, which is a promissory note, which is treated as cash. Where do any credit advertisements explain that in a clear fashion?
It's like they say, isn't it? If anybody understood how the system was working, they'd think twice before they used it.
Well, man, I tell you what, I mean, you know, I've been in discussion with quite a few reliable and trusted rabbits, and, you know, I think we're going to be getting there. I think, you know, whether or not the gatekeepers armed with their guns and other weapons, you know, want to allow us through, the point of the action that I've now instigated is that it is to make a point. And if people follow suit on this, then the idea is that I don't necessarily expect them to play ball with me and allow what I'm intending to do to get through, and I'll explain what I've done in a mo. But it begins to turn up the heat, because there's going to come a time when if the tide of people is so strong and is amassing to such an extent that they just can't fob off and keep the lie up any longer, then they're going to have to do something to correct what's actually been perpetrated here.
And so, in fairness, they every single maneuver that's made along these lines, they do try to respond to, don't they?
Oh, they try to respond to. I mean, most of the inquiries I've ever made, and I know a lot of other people get this, is that, you know, if you pay a loan off or a credit card off, you demand the return of the credit agreement, and they might say, well, you know, depending on what we've written in the letter, they might say it's not a promissory note, it's not negotiable, it's not a negotiable instrument. You know, we're not obliged to give it back. Well, first and foremost, any letters of that nature are evidence of fraud by false representation, so keep them. They're really useful. Okay. Secondly, whilst they may not be under an obligation to return it, I'm not under an obligation to let them keep it. So that's the way I play that one. And, you know, I constantly, I've been battering every now and then at various banks, including the, and the police, trying to get this reported as a crime and trying to get this actioned as a crime for the last 18 months or so. And, you know, I've received a whole host of absolute tosh from some of these people. When it comes down to the banks, the situation is, and I have some of this on film, and it's going to be uploaded at some point, but the police, whether it's the City of London, Metropolitan, Essex Police, Cirrus Fraud Office, Action Fraud, any of these people, they're under the illusion that they have to refer any allegation of fraud committed by a financial institution, they're under the illusion it has to be referred to the Financial Ombudsman Service. Now, the Financial Ombudsman Service, I did a Freedom of Information request with them to find out how many cases of fraud they'd monitored and reported to the police, and they came back and said, zero. We don't monitor fraud committed by banks. Right?
They don't monitor fraud committed by banks.
No. And the reason they don't monitor it, and it's quite an obvious one, is that there's a clear conflict of interest because the Financial Ombudsman Service is funded by, have a guess,
the banks.
The banks and the financial institutions. So
do they claim that the Ombudsman's independent, or is that one of the places where they don't use the word independent? I'm interested.
No, it's all quite open. The government, when they appointed the Financial Ombudsman Service to handle complaints from the financial services industry, it was all quite open in as much as they dictated that the complaints handling service should be funded by the industry. Now, that all kind of sounds fair from that perspective. However, if you go onto the Financial Ombudsman Service website, it clearly defines banks and financial institutions as its customers. It even provides training days for financial institutions so that these institutions and the staff can understand how the Financial Ombudsman Service works. And I have, of course, written into the Ombudsman Service, and I'm waiting for a response to see whether or not they offer the same facility to people, the little guys, you know, you and me.
Yeah.
Because if they don't, well, then that's clear biased. And every complaint that gets passed over from a financial institution to the Financial Ombudsman Service earns the Financial Ombudsman Service the princely sum of £450. So in other words, what we have, looking at it from a different perspective, is that we have the banks who are supposed to provide this service, supposed to be clear, fair, and not misleading. They have their own conflict of interest policies where they're supposed to look after customers. But what it basically turns into a situation where the bank can perhaps lower its staffing levels and save costs, not handle a complaint, merely churn out the 5-day holding letter, the 4-week letter, which says we're still investigating, the 8-week letter, which says, oh, we can't investigate this, we can't resolve this, we suggest you take it to the ombudsman, and then they farm the complaint over to the ombudsman, pay the ombudsman £450, and say, there you go, boys, you sort it out. Now, bearing in mind that the ombudsman actively seeks customers and is now seeking customers from outside the financial services industry, okay?
Yeah.
What we clearly have is the Ombudsman Service, which is a private business entity, okay, which is effectively seeking custom and business in the form of complaints handling. Now, you're not going to upset your customers, defined by the Ombudsman Service as being
the banks,
the banks and the financial institutions. You're not going to upset them by ruling against them all the time and doing a good investigative job. What you're going to do is you're going to try and strike a happy balance. You're going to try and give the illusion to people that, yeah, you know, we've looked at it and we've come up with X, Y, Z determination. Here's a little bit of compo, perhaps. And according to their own statistics, I think they've awarded out, excluding PPI, it's a very low percentage of success rate. I think it's less than 50%. With PPI, I think it's around about, I think it's either 51 or 61%.
And even then, as we might get, I might get a chance to talk about that a little later, but the levels of compensation are nothing even approaching the levels of money, mate, are they?
Not at all. And the funny thing is, I think the average award is 2,200 quid, but I think that's including PPIs. However, people should be aware, and I have started using the Financial Ombudsman Service. I've started utilizing them, and where my interactions with a bank might be a lot, you know, very, very kind of testing and very difficult. What I'm now doing is I'm utilizing the Ombudsman Service, and I'm now managing the Ombudsman Service to manage them, to manage the bank. And I'm managing the Ombudsman Service using the Freeman techniques in terms of, well, you know, not doing the affidavits and stuff, but just using the questioning techniques and the techniques which put them into a position where I, you know, ask them to, well, okay, well, then you show that that means that, because if, you know, or you show cause why that's the case, or you prove that you investigated this, because if you have investigated this, why haven't you come up with the same conclusion I have? You're supposed to be the professional, and yet I found all this stuff out. Why didn't you find this stuff out? Have you done your job properly? If you haven't done your job properly, why are you fobbing me off with X, Y, Z?
It is the by their deeds shall you know them, isn't it?
They
can talk and write as much as they like, but if they're claiming to do something and not coming up with the same evidence as you, then really questions need to be asked.
Absolutely. And when we come back to conflicts of interest, you know, one of my issues is with a company called Sainsbury's Bank. And who happens to sit on the board of directors of Sainsbury's Bank? Well, it's a young lady called Gwyn Burr. And who happens to sit on the Financial Ombudsman Service board? Well, it's Gwyn Burr. So we have someone from the banks, right? I mean, again, it's incestuous. And okay, from one perspective, you'd say, well, industry experts are going to move around these industry bodies. Fair enough. However, when you've got a company such as Sainsbury's Bank, and I'm pleased to actually, you know, declare that as far as I'm concerned, they are committing fraud in conjunction with Bank of Scotland. Okay, and if they don't like that, and I've said this to them repeatedly, if you don't like that comment, sue me. Sue me.
But your directors... have they?
No.
I wonder why not.
I know. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the directors at Sainsbury's Bank are engaged in fraud. And if none of them like that, search, you know, email me at whiterabbiteducation@gmail.com. I'll reveal my name and location. You sue me, and I'll gladly see you there. Because I can prove, which is what a defamation claim would require, I can prove you're committing fraud. So bring it on. Now, the situation is that we cannot rely on, or I say we can't rely, we can't rely on the Ombudsman Service to necessarily do a great investigation. However, if we manage them correctly, and I can come on, I think I've touched on this with the mortgage thing previously, but, you know, I haven't paid the mortgage since May last year. Santander don't even want to talk to me, and the Ombudsman has now agreed that my suggestion that Santander, the Ombudsman, and me get around a table and have a cup of tea and a nice chat is a good idea, right? But just so that people are aware what the Ombudsman can do if you manage them correctly, they can demand and order a waiver of any balance, whether it's unsecured or secured or any investment product, insurance product, whatever.
Can they, right? Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's an action. They've got a tooth.
Yeah. And secondly, they can demand compensation or a reimbursement of payments up to, I think it was £140,000.
Wow.
So they've got the teeth. The question is, are they going to bite down and use them, right?
How are you finding them to get on with? I mean, is it a matter of chatting with them, or do you have to do it all in proper paperwork, the Ombudsman, that is?
The Ombudsman goes through a three-tier complaint process, although today I was told it was a two-tier complaint process. Tier number one is the standard fob-off, so they probably will find against you. And they'll hope that they'll give you some kind of blasé response, and they'll probably hope that you go away. If you then appeal that, and I appealed my first one with Santander, with questions of, well, okay, they came back with certain answers. And I said, well, okay, well, you prove that, 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 you prove that. And thus far, they seem to be stumped.
Because in fairness, with the Santander, you had them pretty much bang to rights. It's difficult to imagine how they could turn that particular one down. Well, I suppose they just do it as a matter of course to all the letters they get, do they, first off?
Well, perhaps. But of course, you see, the thing is, if we manage this correctly, and this will come into the action that I'm taking at the moment against the unsecured creditors or alleged creditors. If we do this correctly, then if the ombudsman doesn't do their job, who do you think you can sue next? The ombudsman.
I guess, yeah.
Now, the thing is, going back to that question or that point I was making about, 2 + 2 = 4, 2 + 2 = 4, 2 + 2 = 4, doesn't matter how you look at it, which jurisdiction, 2 + 2 = 4, right? Now, at the end of the day, we know, right? We know that we're not getting these instruments back. We know how they're defined. We know how they're treated, which is as cash. So we know that the security, the credit agreement or the loan document, the note, is treated as cash. We know it's a valuable instrument in the hands of a banker. So what we're basically saying is, and this is the way I've started explaining it to police and so on and so forth, and it seems to come across a lot better when you explain it as follows. If I were to deposit a gold watch as a security for an unsecured loan, what we're basically saying is that the bank gets paid back, gets interest, then sells the gold watch and keeps the proceeds, and that's all okay, is it?
Well, it's an expensive business, banking.
Well, it is when you're a customer.
Yeah.
So the situation is that tends to actually get them understanding that, okay, all we've got to do is establish that this document is a security. And in this dossier, it's a 34-page dossier, which I've prepared. It took me 2 weeks to do this. Changing it and amending it and cutting and pasting and so on and so forth. But if anybody wants this, email me at whiterabbiteducation@gmail.com and I will ping it back to you. And please feel free to use it for your benefit. And so this is the games play that I've now instigated, all right, in a nutshell. I filed, because I'd come out of the bankruptcy and all the credit had been wrapped up in the bankruptcy and I was planning to manage the official receiver, which he proved to be a little bit unmanageable, I've now arranged for that bankruptcy to be reopened up, and on the 8th of February, which is next Friday, down at South End of the County Court, 3 p.m., I'm going to be going into a hearing with the Treasury solicitor, okay, their barrister, who is a chap from Erskine Chambers, and there's a funny story about this chap in a moment, but I'm going to be going into court with these guys, and I'm after an order to compel the official receiver to go back and do his job and collect the assets which are due to me, put them into the bankrupt estate, settle all the alleged debt, right, and then give me the proceeds, right, anything which, that's left
which,
over.
Which was surely his job in the first place.
Which was his job in the first place. And just to recap what people might have missed when we went off air a little bit, I did a data subject access request when I came out of the bankruptcy on the 25th of August 2011. I did a data subject access request. Now, I didn't get it through till last year. And this data subject access request has revealed that someone at the official receivers basically thought up when I was saying, look, there's assets held over at the banks that belong to me, i.e. the credit entries. There's liens. They basically came up with the thought process that they didn't think that there'd be much value, so they didn't bother to go and look. And they also commented, right, and this is an important thing, they actually passed a comment three times in their paperwork that I now have, stating that, well, even if there are funds due to Master Spaniard, each financial institution will be entitled to set off what they owe to Master Spaniard against what he owes to them under Section 323 of the Insolvency Act 1986. Therefore, it's not worthwhile pursuing that, so we'll just let the financial institutions levy and make false claims against the bankrupt estate, which in itself is a criminal offence.
What about the statement they made? Can you just read that to me again?
They basically said...
Yeah.
I'm doing this off the top of my head. They basically said... that if they were to chase up these financial institutions for the funds that I was stating were owed to me,
yeah,
and these are the credit entries, because remember, if they can't give you the security back, they owe you the face value.
Yeah, yeah.
They said that each institution would be entitled under Section 323 of the Insolvency Act 1986 to apply what's called set-off or offset.
Yeah.
And anyone that's followed Winston Shrout's stuff will recognise that terminology. In other words, when we go and take out a loan with the bank is going to, okay, it gives us access. Some banks have now been openly stating that what they do is they don't lend money, they do a currency exchange. Well, no shit, right? It's our currency for their currency. Yeah. But, you know, depending on how you look at it, it's actually our credit entry to begin with. So they're engaging in usufruct for a start. That's using our property for their profit and gain, right? So that's fraud. They're not lending anything. So that's fraud based on their representations in their advertisements. So when you hand over that note, let's say a £10,000 loan note, the moment you hand that over to the bank, at some point in time, they're going to owe that back to you, right? Normally, most people, and when I was working in banking back in 1992, up to 1992, I can remember we sent these documents back to customers when they paid off their loans.
Yeah.
But nowadays, and I've worded this not in a kind of conspiratorial manner, but I've worded this from the point of view of, it's come to my attention that over the past 20 years or so, this process has grown in popularity, right, amongst some firms. So in other words, it's limiting the number of firms that are potentially engaged in this fraudulent activity, which hopefully makes it more attractive to the police and regulators to go investigate.
Yeah.
So in essence,
I wondered why you'd used some banks, because as far as I can see, it is pretty much right across the piece. Yeah,
of course it is. But
the choice of words is so important, isn't it?
Absolutely. So that it doesn't come across as some crazed conspiracy theorist, you know, coming up with X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that, look, you know, each of these institutions that I've been dealing with are not returning the documents. Now, that document is a security. And once we establish that it is a security and it's a valuable instrument in the hands of a bank, that effectively is like a gold watch. So the point is that once we've repaid their currency with interest, they now owe us back that note. So if they can't provide us with that note or the gold watch, whether they've lost it or destroyed it, they owe us the face value of that. I mean, that's common sense.
Because now, they've made it. They've actually sold it and made that money, even though you couldn't, they could. And if they've sold it, it's your cash.
Absolutely. So depending on how we look at that, either way, they're withholding the face value of that instrument or that security, that valuable instrument, they're withholding that from us and they've kept it for themselves. Now, that's fraud, right? Now, whether they've actually sold the note or whether they've just destroyed the note to disguise the fact that they didn't lend you anything in the first place, either way, it's fraud and they are profiting from that and we are losing from that because if it were a proper loan, we would be entitled, let's say it's the 10 grand loan, we'd be entitled to, they owe us 10 grand, we owe them 10 grand, offset it, all we owe them is the interest.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
And so we're losing. Now that's fraud. There's no two ways about it. It's fraud. And the moment that they start manipulating accounting entries, well, then that breaches the Theft Act 1968, Section 17, which covers false accounting. And that's a 7-year jail term. Now, they are categorically doing this. Categoric. There's
and
no reason
about they are, it. They are categorically and systematically denying it as well, because I know, like you say, you've been at them on the phone and by letter, for, and even going down the police station and having a word with policemen about it. And everybody's denying it.
Well, the funny thing is, obviously, most letters will come back out from junior bods. All right. And of course, these junior staff, what they're not doing when they say they're going to investigate, and this is where our management skills come into play. When they say they're going to investigate, we need to manage them to ensure that they have investigated it and not just turned around and asked Bill in, you know, their manager, oh, what's XYZ? And he says XYZ. And so they type that up in the letter and off it goes. Yeah. That's not an investigation, right? Because if they had investigated it, how could they not come up with the same information that I've come up with?
Yeah.
Exactly.
So they have, you're kind of, you, if they do investigate, they will learn as well.
Absolutely. And what I, what I've emphatically do with these people is that I try to talk to them from the point of view. In fact, my opening gambit nowadays is, look, you know, if you've had a loan or a credit card, go and check this out, because you, the company probably owes you money back. Right. So please use this. And then I send them my document and I say, please download a copy yourself. Pass it to your friends and family. Right. And I also like to address my letters nowadays to whoever it is that's reading the letter. I actually make a point of I say, look, this has been addressed to you, the one reading this, because this is going to affect you just as much as it's affecting me. And whether it, whether you have or haven't had a mortgage or a loan or whatever, please read this. You know, I don't want you to stick your neck on the line, but please read it. And if you can benefit from this information, please do. Now, every time I've done that, I've had zero response. I think it completely throws them into pandemonium. They can't cope with it.
And yes, it is. It is bringing to the fore one of the most important points that we make so regularly, which is that all the people that are in a, an apparent position of authority or a uniform style of dress or whatever are simply like us. They have the same problems as the ones we're trying to address. They just haven't recognized it yet.
Absolutely. And the funny thing was that, you know, I mean, I most recently I went down to Holloway Police Station and tried to report this. And apart from the fact that the civilian was a bit of a wally and didn't know what he was talking about and didn't even really show much interest, the good thing was when I then, because he didn't do that, I've gone through their process. I registered a formal professional standards complaint, right? So this, what I'm doing now is I'm going through, and anyone and everyone that comes into contact and doesn't do their jobs, they get a complaint, because that's going to go on their file and that's going to be held against them. And then if necessary, depending on the severity of what they've done, depends on whether I do push it or whether I then say, well, okay, just give them a ticking off and I will let it go. But the main
thing is very much Guy Taylor's approach as well, as he says, you work out what they're doing to you and hold a mirror up to it.
Sure. Now, the funny thing is that the copper that was actually investigating the civilian under the professional standards complaint, when I spoke to him, and he tried to not fob me off, but he gave the standard kind of email response. And then I said, no, 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 I'm not happy with that. I want to speak to you. He spent about 40 minutes on the phone with me, and I explained how this all worked. And he said, you know what, Si? He said, after you came in, he said, myself and a member of staff from CID spent 3 days trying to find out about securities and commercial instruments. And we couldn't find anything. So I said to him, well, don't worry. I've prepared a 34-page dossier. Do you want me to email it to you? And he said, yes. So I did. Now, the thing is, what I've done with this dossier, and this is where I want what I want everyone to know about, is that obviously I've got the hearing next weekend, next Friday. And I don't know whether the county court judge is going to play ball with me or not. And I've got an interesting anecdote about him in a moment. But what I've done is I'm now seeking – I've declared in a statutory declaration that they have committed fraud, that they have committed theft, that they have breached the Consumer Credit Act, that they have breached the Protection from Harassment Act for sending arrears letters out when I owed nothing, that they have breached the Misrepresentation Act. And I've stated it. I've declared it. Then I've given all the definitions, so I've proven, as far as I'm concerned –
and the sources, so that your police can go and get himself a decent dictionary.
Absolutely. So I've given all the sources, and I've done a 4-page statutory declaration with attachments, and the attachments are 28 pages. I had it all done and dusted. And what I've done is I've invited a whole host of people to rebut it under penalty of perjury with full liability, right? I've not mentioned, you know, I just want them to come out and state. And in fact, I haven't even asked them to do that up front. I've just said, I want you to state that you're prepared to do that. Because if they come back and say they're prepared to do that, you know what I'm going to do next. I'm going to demand that they do.
Yeah.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, in order to actually prove me wrong, they are going to have to prove that the Acts of Parliament are incorrect, that Stroud's Judicial Dictionary is rubbish, and that Lord Denning was wrong. So good luck on that one, right? And I've even had chats with barrister chambers as I've been going around formulating all the complaints against any barristers that have been involved in court cases with me, any solicitors that have been involved. And I spoke to one head of chambers. I explained very briefly what was in this statutory declaration. And I said, do you have any comment? And he said, well, there's absolutely nothing I can say. He had no argument. Because barristers and solicitors, when they're taking on these cases against us, if you raise any kind of question mark as to the validity of the claim that they are propagating, they have a duty
to investigate, right?
Okay. Yeah. Now, not only do they have a duty to investigate the claim that they are propagating themselves to make sure they're not interacting and engaging in fraud, but if any other solicitor at that firm or any other firm becomes aware of this activity, they too have a duty to act in accordance with everything that's stated on the Solicitors Regulation Authority website.
So right? He's effectively maintaining his right to silence.
Well, he's got the formal complaint, let's put it this way, for one of the barristers that was involved in one of these cases. And so, in a nutshell, what I've done is I've copied this document into the following parties. Obviously, it's gone into Southend County Court. It's gone to the Treasury solicitor, together with an offer to pay off all of the outstanding debt on condition they provide proof of loss and they return the original, unmarked, signed loan agreements, right? Which they can't do. I've made this offer three times to the Treasury solicitor, and funnily enough, they don't want to accept the offer.
Oh, he has agreed to talk to you, apparently.
He's going to be talking to me in court, man. I mean, I phoned up one of their guys, a guy called Andrew Churek, and he couldn't get off the phone quick enough. I did film it, but unfortunately, I didn't have a good phone at that point in time. But this document, okay, which is for public dissemination, I've stated it quite clearly. This is all going into a court of public record for the court of public opinion. This has gone out to the following parties. Okay, so whichever area you're in, people listening to this, you should be able to take this up with your local constabulary, because this document has been sent and emailed to every single police and crime commissioner operating within the UK jurisdiction, together with each chief constable operating within every constabulary within the UK jurisdiction. It's gone to Theresa Mary May, responsible for the police. It's gone to Dominic Grieve, the Attorney General, ultimately responsible for the Treasury Solicitor's Office. It's gone to Oliver Heald, the Solicitor General, also responsible for the Treasury Solicitor's Office. It's gone to the Treasury Solicitor, Sir Paul Jenkins, who's responsible for all the official receivers. It's gone to the official receiver himself, Philip Robinson, down at Southend-on-Sea. Hiya, Philip, how are you doing? It's gone to the Baroness Ruth Beach at the Bar Standards Council. It's gone to the Chief Exec of the Solicitors Regulation Authority. It's gone also off to various newspapers, local press, to see whether they were interested. But it's then gone to each of the following banks, which is Capital One, First Direct, which is HSBC, the world's local money launderer, MBNA, Sainsbury's Bank, and I've sent it to Jay Sainsbury's as well, Justin King, Chief Exec of Sainsbury's, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Halifax Bank of Scotland, part of Lloyds Banking Group. Now, it's gone to the solicitors which acted in those cases and the barristers which acted in those cases and any debt collectors which happened to get involved as well. And it's also gone to the Financial Ombudsman Board, the Office of Fair Trading Board, and I've sent it to the British Bankers Association inviting them to rebut it as well. So it's gone to Adam Cull, Policy Director. It's gone to Anthony Brown, Chief Executive. David Swanee, who's formerly a chartered accountant with KPMG, so he should know what he's talking about. So I've invited him to rebut it, together with Paul Chisnell, who's also another Executive Director of Financial Policy. And I've invited all these parties to rebut the fact that the credit agreement is indeed a promissory note, which is a security, which is negotiable, and is treated as cash for accounting purposes.
And, of course, you've served these documents effectively on the principals, haven't you?
So they've gone to the principals. They've gone to – I've also got a list of every single junior member of staff that refused to investigate or didn't – or claimed to have investigated, that sent arrears letters or that even sent letters stating that it, you know, the document was not a note, was not a promissory note, was not negotiable, was not a security, and so on and so forth. Because this document now – and I've served notice to this up-and-coming bankruptcy, bankruptcy hearing, where I'm seeking to annul the bankruptcy under Section 282 of the Insolvency Act, Subsection 1. I've now basically stated, well, okay, you're either going to annul this and resolve this all administratively. If not, this is going criminal. Your choice. Your choice, because ultimately, you know, if you don't want this to go criminal, then resolve it. Go collect the asset. If you don't want to collect the asset, it's going criminal. And potentially
they are between a rock and a hard place, aren't they, that?
Well, you know, again, I don't know whether they're going to give me any kind of, you know, obstruction in trying to get this criminal complaint through. But what I am doing, you know, I've copied in the CPS because you can get the criminal, if you want the procedures for filing a criminal prosecution, private prosecution, go to the CPS website. It's all there, nicely laid out for you. The only thing that doesn't work are the links to the templates for the indictments. Right? Surprise, surprise. They don't work, right? However, you can go into, I think, the actual court procedures, and I think it tells you how it's laid out. And it's very, very simplistic. You just put the word indictment at the top, basically, and it's pretty much like a stat deck. So I've done a statutory declaration.
And your criminal prosecution doesn't cost you anything, I'm told.
Well, this is the key with criminal prosecutions. Get this. Number one, if it's a private prosecution, right, if you get to handle it yourself, and I've offered to assist the CPS in handling this as an expert, right, and banking, I don't want to do all the work. I don't mind them doing the work. And, you know, we'll get it nice and nicely well publicized. And other people around the country are invited to do this, maybe just on one. You know, see if you can get it reported to the police. See if you can get them to actually accept this report of a crime, a stolen security, or the theft of a documentary intangible. That's the accounting entry. If not, file in a private prosecution, okay? Because if you can handle this yourself, you can actually apply to GCHQ, I think it is, or the Central Court Office, and you get paid between 200 to £300 per hour whilst you are doing your work on the private prosecution. That's good salary, man.
I didn't know that.
Ah, it's good salary. So it's well worthwhile issuing a criminal prosecution, right?
And strictly speaking, surely, if you've notified all of these principals, then all of their agents have effectively been notified as well.
Absolutely, but I've taken great joy, as I say, in preparing a list of these people, because if the criminal prosecution proceeds, if it proceeds, and you know, part of me doesn't expect it to, but I'm just starting to apply the pressure, starting to let them know that I'm knocking on that door. I'm looking at that avenue now, right? And anyone that wants to obstruct, well, I now have, as far as I'm concerned, I will have rights of criminal prosecution against them. Mm-hmm. So I've also attached to this document at the back, straight off the CPS website, is all the misconduct in public office stuff.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. In other words, if they don't act, then, you know, it's a case of, well, either you do the banks or I do you. Which would you like? Your choice.
Misconduct in public office is not one of those ones that's been adequately legislated for, has it? So it's quite difficult for them to get out from under.
Well, it's repeated acts, you know, and it's quite clearly defined in the on the CPS website. And again, even if it gets knocked back, you know, look, there are a few things that there are a few old sayings and a few thought processes, and this is where I'm coming from. You know, the first is this. Excuse me for being so kind of, shall we say, disgusting when I say this. But number one, when the shit hits the fan, people run for cover. Why? Because they don't want to get covered in shit, and shit sticks. Right. So the first things first is that by singling out, and what I've done is on this document, I've singled out the banks and the official receiver, and I've copied in all the other people as professional observers. Right. Professional observers, yeah, to pass comment and give their testimony. And then I've copied in all the police enforcement agencies. So I'm really singling out certain parties because, as I say, when the shit sticks, when the shit hits the fan, people in those companies or those offices are going to want to hopefully distance themselves from the main culprits, right? There's going to be a lot of finger pointing going on. And anyone that works for a big company knows that this happens, right? You do what your boss tells you. Turns out it goes wrong. All of a sudden they drop you. They hang you out to dry, right? And you're screwed, right? Yeah. So this happens all the time in companies. So that's the first thing. The second thing is when it comes down to this statutory declaration, we know that when we're interacting with these parties, that it's like playing a game of poker, right? Everything is a play. Think about it. You know, when we're out, it's acts of parliament. We're actors. We're acting. They're acting. It's a play. But they're making a play in as much as they're making a gamble. Can they con you? Can they get one over on you? Now, if we use that metaphor, that analogy, you're playing a game of poker with these guys and girls. But the beautiful thing is, but once you've researched all this kind of stuff for a period of time, you know what their hand is, and you know they've got jack shit. They're bluffing. It's like sitting there with a mirror reflecting their hand, and you can see their hand, and you know they've got nothing. Therefore, have no fear in declaring fraud every time. We do it on, I do it on PCNs, parking charge notices, yeah?
Yeah.
And it's kicked every single one into touch because we declared that they are committing fraud, and they then have to prove that they're not.
That's very much, again, like what Guy Taylor was telling us a couple of weeks back, is that whatever civil procedure it is that's being applied to you is fraudulent, and all you've got to do is detect the fraud to be able to turn it criminal and flip it back the other way.
Absolutely. So you declare the fraud, and all of a sudden, because there's no smoke without fire, all the old sayings come into play, you know, shit sticks and this, that and the other, all of a sudden, you know, they run, and you start seeing amazing things happen. Now, there's another little analogy and another little saying, and this is where I'm coming from on this. If we have the analogy of a football game, you know, if you're not attacking, then the chances are you're probably defending. And if you're defending, we know that in court, you're losing. So to have the analogy of a football game, if you're on the defense and you're in your own 18-yard box, they're presumably going to be firing shots at your goal, all right, to beat you. So in many respects, you don't want to defend. You want to go on the attack. And so my new kind of attitude with this is that, okay, guys and girls, all this alleged debt has been wiped off in a bankruptcy. You know, I know the reaction that I've had when I've started mentioning this stuff, because I've been speaking to the banks still over the last 18 months. They don't want to come back to me. They say they're going to investigate. They don't come back to me at all, period, right? They are scared of this. They are scared of this stuff. And so if they're scared of it, hey, use it, right? Because they've been playing on our fear. So now the tables are turning, right? And now we can play on their fear, because with complete confidence, I'm happy to go into court and declare that they have committed fraud. If they want to sue me for defamation, go ahead. I welcome it. I invite it. Let's go for it. But I don't think they're going to get anywhere. And as far as I'm concerned, I believe I can prove fraud. There's no doubt about it.
And so basically, I guess the thing is that the groups of people can only they can keep encouraging each other to stay stum for so long, but eventually somebody is going to want to get away from where the orgy is going to hit, and at that point it won't be one person, it'll probably be quite a lot of them.
Well, absolutely. Well, let's look at it this way, right? You know, I was a bank manager, right? I was quite a saddo. In terms of, I used to read all their documents. I used to read the credit agreements, and I didn't, obviously, reading in the wrong language, I didn't understand, you know, I made the credit agreements and that language fit what I did as a job, right, as opposed to doing it the correct way around. So, yeah, me being negligent, really. But I never, ever had any of these kind of complaints, like the Freeman complaints, where I had to go and investigate, because if I had received those, the chances are I would have known about this stuff a long time ago. So I can tell you categorically that junior members of staff do not know this stuff. However, if you write to them and they write back and say they're going to do an investigation, there is no excuse for them not knowing this, especially if you help them out a little bit with the direction. There's no excuse. If they have done an investigation, then they should find out what you know and what I know and what everybody else out there now knows, right? So if they come back with anything other than a response that concurs with our findings, they've not done the job, which means that by stating they have investigated it, that in itself is aiding and abetting and it is also fraud by false representation. They've not done the job.
Do you think this information is available to them, given the feedback you got from the CID and the police and stuff about how they'd spent 3 days looking at it and found nothing? Mind you, it does have to be said they've had major investigations into satanic child abuse and found nothing as well.
All right. So, well, I can tell you internally at the bank, they would not have any information that they could refer to.
They'd have to go elsewhere, wouldn't they?
They would have to go outside the bank to find this stuff, because the policy manuals within the banks, okay, are such that it just basically defines what their job is and how to key things into the system and what to put in that box and what to put in that box and what to keep on file. And this raises another interesting thing. When banks are saying that they keep losing these documents, well, apart from the obvious that a bank is supposed to keep things safe, the second thing is, I can tell you for fact, in every institution I've worked at, the staff knew and the branch managers knew they had to keep all their records for 7 years. We never used to throw anything away. We kept it all. Period.
Yeah.
We photocopied. If a customer came in, produced pay slips, bank statements, you know, proof of address, proof of ID, we took photocopies of it all. We used to sign those photocopies to say that they were genuine and sign them off. You know, we'd complete all these audit sheets. We'd have to write up why we did the loan, the reasons for the loan, the credit search, the application form. If we didn't keep the original in the file, in a normal filing cabinet, we would take the original credit agreement and put it in a fire safe.
Right.
They do not lose those documents. You'd get the odd one, which would be misfiled, granted, but they don't lose them on the scale that they are claiming to have lost them. And I've even seen some banks actually stating, especially HBOS, they state that they actually destroy them. Why? Because with all these arguments about credit agreements, why would the bank choose to do that and bring further suspicion on itself? But the common sense thing would be to do is just purely prove that there's nothing untoward is going on and shut everybody up. So why don't they do that?
Quite apart from anything else, you told us exactly why earlier on that actually destroying these documents is itself unlawful.
Absolutely. It's destroying the evidence. And that's why they destroy them. There is no logical reason coming from an ex-bank employee who wrote policy in some areas of operation, who used to train other branch managers, okay, who used to even, I even trained up an area manager, right? Because the thing that which obviously never got me promoted was my big mouth, right? So the fact of the matter is, there is absolutely no logical reason why the bank would not have those documents. The odd one in a thousand, perhaps, by chance, things do go missing. But not on the scale that these places are claiming. And so that's what's prompted me to then start doing these videos, because obviously I'm used to phoning up banks and, you know, hopefully I sound slightly professional when I'm on the phone. So I've started engaging in conversations with the investment departments at these banks, and that's what some of the videos are tailored to present on the YouTube channel, to show, in their words, admissions as to what these documents are. And I've already had admission from Lloyds Banking Group that the document, the credit agreement, is a promissory note. The guy couldn't make up his mind whether it did belong to the customer or whether it belonged to the bank, but he certainly agreed, okay, that it was a promissory note, and he then even concurred that it should be returned to the customer at the end of the agreement. So obviously he, selling the investment bonds, you know, which link in and are backed by all these loans, when they bundle it all up, he's under the impression, again, compartmentalized, that everything else that goes on in the other side of the bank is going on in a bona fide fashion.
Yeah.
It's the old compartmentalization, right?
Yeah.
What he's not seeing is that, and I can say to this, as someone that has run a claims management company, okay, so back in 2008, I had the claims management company, and I had loads of customers, and all I can tell you is, none of them was I able to achieve a return, even in exchange for settlement and closure, of an original credit agreement. We've done it. We've offered to pay off people's debt loads of times on exchange of that. Not happened. I've offered to do it on all my creditors. They don't want to know. I've offered to do it with the Treasury solicitor. He doesn't even want to respond. So you have to say to yourself, well, with the economy in the way that it is, why would the Treasury Solicitor's Office want to discharge all this debt and not get it paid off? I'm offering to pay it off.
Yeah.
And I can tell you why they don't want to pay it off. And it's because I believe they're either destroying the documents to conceal the fact that they didn't grant a loan in the first place, right? Or, as I got it from Bank of Scotland on the phone once, they offered me, under the tag of commercial paper, bundles of consumer credit agreements. And when I actually said to the guy,
wow,
right, you know, do your customers know you're doing this? He hung up.
Well,
I've got it on tape somewhere, but I redo it.
That's brilliant. You have got it on tape. Wicked.
I've got it on tape somewhere. What I've done is today, I've got to upload this one, but I spoke to Barclays Bank today and made another inquiry. One of the Barclays staff admitted that they do sell credit agreements. And I went through to another guy. He didn't know too much about that, but I got some more information about how they set up these trust funds, the SPVs, special purpose vehicles, and how they sell. They then issue a bond against that debt. So they issue, the bank issues a bond, which is a security. It's a, they offer like a certain interest rate for a certain investment. And as customers pay, the payments are classed as going into this SPV, this special purpose vehicle, which then pays out an income to the investors. But the investors can then insure against customers not paying by taking out what are called CDSs, or credit swaps, credit default swaps. But as is on the Lloyds Bank presentation, investors can actually take out credit default swaps for an amount vastly in excess of the value of the fund. So they actually make money when we fail.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. Yeah, that's another example of something we see quite a lot of, isn't it?
Sure.
This is fairly simple individual action by asking for your note back. Almost whatever happens, you're going to get some kind of admission from the bank that they've either lost it or destroyed it, and that's mostly what's going to come back. And straight away, that gives you a bit of an in. And the other thing is that by addressing all these different individuals at all these different levels, you get a whole load of different documentation back with different accidental admissions in them, because they don't necessarily know what they're saying.
Well, the thing is as well, I mean, you're absolutely correct, but the thing is as well, what we have to understand is that slowly but surely people are getting educated. Because even when I educated this copper the other day, he said to me, his response was, and this, you know, so here's an objection that people might come up against. His objection was, but I don't actually have to pay anything extra, do I? If I pay off my loan for 10 grand plus 2 grand interest, the fact that they've kept the security or the document doesn't mean I have to pay off anything extra. Well, there's a potential liability on that, which I won't cover now, but if that promise is floating out there somewhere, believe me, I have seen people be chased for loans that have been paid off. I've had it done to me. Firsthand, yeah. Right? Yeah. Twice by Halifax, right? So that does happen. But the second thing was, I said to him, well, you're right. At face value, you're absolutely correct. If the bank has kept that document, they're not going to ask you to pay anything more, right? But do you agree in giving the banker an extra 10 grand that he can then spend on stuff that you didn't know you were going to be giving him?
Yeah.
And then the copper actually went, I see where you're coming from. Because bankers, you know, let's put it this way. General members of staff who are slogging their guts out 12 hours a day, telesales centers, whatever it is, you know, they're just doing their jobs. They don't know. They're just like us. They've got loans, credit cards, HP, mortgages, everything, right? They're struggling just as much as everybody else. So they're not going to know. And they've got a good excuse not to know. I didn't know. There you go. However, can the executives who are walking away with 1 million, 2 million, 10 million, 50 million pound annual salaries and packages and bonus packages, you're telling me that these guys and girls don't know how it works? The average guy or girl is going to earn no more than, say, 750,000 to a million pounds in a lifetime. So from 18 to 70, what's that? 52 years.
Yeah.
Whereas these guys, the bankers, are earning far in excess of that in 1 year.
Yeah.
And anyone that wants to see the investigation that took place in the States, go look at Inside Job with Matt Damon, right? It's fantastic. The Lehman Brothers guy paid himself, before Lehman Brothers went bust, he paid himself $500 million in 1 year.
Wow.
1 year, right? Now, I've got some tips in terms of how people can play with any credit that they've got outstanding, right? I've been using this. Quite a few of us have been using this with great success. I have never had one friend that I've intervened for get taken to court as a result of me doing what I'm about to tell you, right? And that is, let's say that, you know, yourself, Dr. Rock, I say to you, hey, you know, Doc, do us a favor. I've got a loan with Barclays. Something tells me that I just can't trust these guys anymore. So I'm gonna deposit all the money that I'm going to pay to Barclays, deposit that with you. And I want you to act as trustee of that, and I want you to release those monies to Barclays on the condition that they arrange a date and time and a place where you can exchange that cash for the return of the original note. And that note's got to be unmarked, no endorsements, no stamps, no seals, together with proof of loss.
Yeah. Right?
Now, the moment that I get a third party involved and I notify Barclays, they might send the odd letter, but they disappear.
Is that right?
I've had it without fail.
Yeah.
You just keep repeating. So in other words, I would get you to write on my behalf as my trustee, because even a verbal arrangement between you and me, you're holding the money on trust, just like me giving you money to go and buy a round of beers, you're doing it on trust. So you're now my trustee, and you are now as a second set of eyes with a different responsibility, because no one can force you to break that trust.
Yeah.
You are now operating for me, and you're liaising with Barclays. So people at home listening to this, do a team up with your friends, maybe operate as a out of a mailbox, maybe give that trust relationship with your friend a name, maybe give it a letterhead, and then that trust writes out to the bank, and any letter the bank sends, you just keep going back nicely, saying, hey, look, you know, I'm happy. The trust is happy to settle and close you. No problem. On condition that you tell us where we can come and meet with you in order to effect the exchange of the settlement for the return of the original unmarked wet note. Yeah, wet marked note.
Yeah.
So it's got to be no other marks on it, but wet signature on that note, that promissory note. We want to know when we can get that security back. Now, we've got the definitions, which undeniably define that note as a security, as cash. And then all of a sudden, things change. The bank tends to run for cover. They might send it to a debt recovery agent. But normally what I've experienced in 2.5 years for a guy that I've been doing this, the one company that's chased up the most, I've had 5 letters from in 2.5 years.
It has to be said that that actually having a trust that does this stuff generally, that deals with all of your things, means that third party is kind of involved, and I've found the same thing more or less applies, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And this is where people need to, you know, whether they're doing this via their, you know, their own little study groups, or whether they're meeting up at a Truth Juice meeting or at a British Constitution group meeting or at a White Rabbit meeting or whatever you call it, right? Work together. Okay, you know, work together in pairs or work together as a group. You know, you could set up one trust for the whole group, okay, and have people just chip in with a bit of admin, okay, or maybe do the administration yourself for your own stuff via that trust.
And of course, this is really brilliant, isn't it? Because effectively what you're doing is, instead of going for your note after the fact, as it were, you're saying, look, I'll give you the money if you give me the note, which is a fair trade.
And then they go away. But this is the way I'm now turning it, because I'm now using that and this additional information to now, I mean, for example, I've got a case for a friend. Barclays have bunged it out to the fourth debt recovery company, right? They've all bugged out. And when this one came on, I said, well, okay, send us proof. Now, they've sent through a photocopy of a statement, which anyone can type up onto the onto a Word document, and they've sent out a photocopy of the credit agreement. So I said, well, no, you know, that's not good enough. A few numbers on a piece of paper is not proof of anything, apart from the fact that you can type, and a photocopy of a credit agreement is not the original. I've now set them a deadline, which ends today, which is, you now come to me with this stuff, because we've had so many false claims against the trust, it's wasting so much of our time, that I'm now demanding you produce this stuff, and if you don't, we're going to prosecute you at the debt recovery company and your directors for engaging in fraud. Oh man, the reaction, right? They do not like it.
I'm just going to do a little advert for Simon Spaniard at this point. There are seminars that he runs, 1 day and 2 day seminars, and they are all full of this stuff. It's the only seminar that's ever kept me awake all day with no problem at all. So
I'll pay you later.
Yeah. No, I'll come along again. I really enjoy them, and it's different every time. That's one of the things I really like about it, is that it's got the same feel, but there's so much of it, you know. Anyway, I've got a question from TRP here, who's asking whether the trick just outlined would work with mortgages.
Well, you've got to remember that a mortgage, obviously, is the bread and butter of these companies, all right?
Massive amounts of money.
Massive amounts. But let me just explain something about the mortgages, okay? In effect, I mean, funny enough, I was discussing this with a trusted bunny. I think he's listening at the moment, so hiya, man. We're going to be probably trialing this against a mortgage company, right? Just to add extra weight. So what I did with my mortgage company is that in learning how this all worked, all right, what I did was I started asking questions. And I specifically, the first question I focused on was the power of attorney that you give them in the terms and conditions the moment that you sign the mortgage deed. It invokes the terms and conditions. Check your terms and conditions. If you haven't got a copy, request a copy and go.
Be prepared to wait 3 years for them, though, eh, Simon?
Well, potentially, yeah, if you're dealing with Santander, the devil himself. But the thing is, get hold of the terms and conditions and hunt through those terms and conditions for the power of attorney. And then very simply, what I then went back to Santander with was this question. What have you done in my name using that power of attorney? Because I have an absolute right to know. And as a second question, it was, well, why didn't you ask me to sign any documents? Because the power of attorney basically says for Santander that they have an irrevocable power of attorney to do anything in my name and create and issue any commercial instruments in my name, all right, which I've allegedly given them permission to sell and keep all the benefits of.
Yeah.
Now, first question, going back to what we covered at the outset of this conversation, according to Principle 7 of the Treating Customers Fairly under the FSA, how is that clear, fair, and not misleading if they don't answer those questions?
Yeah.
And why didn't I know about it before I took the mortgage? Because they're supposed to explain this stuff before you take the mortgage. So if they didn't explain it before and they can't explain it now, as Santander have been telling me for 3.5 years, how can they sell mortgage products? Which is what led me to petition the FSA to suspend Santander's license. I've done this already. Suspend their license for selling mortgage products. And I need to chase that up, actually. So note to self, I need to chase the FSA up tomorrow. But each bank, each mortgage lender, has a dedicated member of staff or rep over at the FSA that liaises with them. Okay? So you need to get these. What I would say is start applying pressure. Start writing into the FSA. You can do an email. So saying, you know, the company that I'm with can't explain this. They're supposed to explain it before I took the product out. I've got the products already. They didn't explain it before. They can't explain it now. How can you possibly allow them to continue selling these products?
Yeah.
They're breaking your rules, Mr. FSA. They're breaking your rules. How can you not act? Because if you don't act, the FSA board, as far as I'm concerned, because they were named in an Act of Parliament, they are tantamount to public servants. And failing to act, if you're acting in the capacity of a public servant, you are a public servant. And if you fail to act, misconduct in public office comes up, and that is a potential life sentence, if found guilty.
Yeah.
So we need to start, I think, rather than focusing on the mafiosa, which is the banks, manage the regulators to manage the banks. And if the regulators don't do their jobs, pick on them because they are easy targets.
Yeah.
And they're worried about their jobs. They're worried about their jobs. So force them to do their jobs. And Vince Cable, as I understand it, is the minister responsible for the finance industry. And under the Carl Toner principle, the minister is ultimately responsible.
Yeah.
So what I would say on the mortgage front, then, just to that chap that or girl that wrote in, whoever that was, I would back up any questions that you're asking the company, the mortgage company, back it up with an offer from a trust. What I did was when they were unable to answer that, and I put in a regulatory complaint to say, well, why aren't you answering this question? When they referred it to the Ombudsman Service, I then declared that the account was in dispute. under their own kind of guidelines. When it's in dispute, they can't demand payment from you. If they do, it's an act of harassment under the Protection from Harassment Act 1997. And I then put in an offer from a trust. In fact, I actually worded it from my auntie. I said, oh, my auntie's offered to pay this all off on condition that you answer this question.
Yeah.
So answer the question. And they don't want to answer the question. I've got 43 solicitors at Santander who do not want to meet with me and do not want to answer that simple question about the mortgage.
They don't want to explain their own terms and conditions and claim that they can't.
They claim that they cannot explain their power of attorney and what it's been used for and why it's even in the terms and conditions. And therefore, if they can't do that, they cannot legally sell a mortgage product.
If you don't understand it, you're not allowed to sell it.
Well, how can you?
No, quite. There's a question from Lee in the chat box here. He says, has Simon looked at the Land Registry Act? It links to the power of attorney too.
I have looked at the Land Registry Act, and I've been making inquiries with Land Registry because what I was – I know that on the one hand, if you make a dispute via Land Registry about a charge, then the Land Registry, in effect, almost becomes a kind of private arbitration court. So they then become judge and jury as to whether something is valid or not. Now, I obtained a certified copy. It cost me 11 quid to obtain a certified copy of the mortgage deed. And the mortgage deed, which is lodged over at Land Registry, does not have anyone else's signature on but mine. Right?
Yeah.
Now this is a funny thing, right? So everyone should be recognizing this process when it comes down to a mortgage. When you sign the mortgage deed, you're always told to leave it blank and don't date it. Now, bearing in mind that I've got it on those presentations on the White Rabbit channel, that these things are being dropped into a special purpose vehicle, which is probably a trust, and that the bank is probably treating itself as beneficiary. In order to set up a trust relationship, there is one fundamental requirement, absolutely fundamental. Without it, you cannot have a trust, and that is intent.
A trust is an expression of intent, isn't it?
Absolutely, right? So, apart from the fact that I didn't have the intent to benefit them, you know, at my expense, the thing is, if you're signing a mortgage deed and you leave it undated, right, the day that you signed it, okay, maybe you intended to execute that deed. But the deed isn't executed unless it's dated. So the day that it was dated, did you intend to execute that deed? Because if you didn't, that's not executed.
It's true. And can you truly be said to have intended to execute it in as far as you don't know about the power of attorney and the terms and conditions?
Absolutely. No, of course you can't. Because, again, you know, this is fraud by false representation. So I can tell you right now, the mortgage has been sold to pretty much everyone under fraud by false representation. Again, they're doing exactly the same thing as I understand it. You know, what they do is they take the power of attorney, they create a promissory note, funnily enough, just like a normal unsecured loan agreement. They take that promissory note, that's what creates the credit entry. The credit entry then funds your loan or your mortgage, so you lend the money to yourself, exactly the same with an unsecured loan or a credit card. And what the bank is doing is then either disposing of that promissory note in some way, shape or form, or selling it on or whatever. But either way, what it's doing is concealing the fact that that thing even exists. When you pay your mortgage off, you're supposed to get that back. I mean, there's so many flaws with a mortgage product. It's unbelievable. Just ask questions. They don't like it at all.
Yeah.
And in essence, just for anyone with the mortgage, just remember this. Okay, one of the definitions on this dossier, which people can obtain, and I'll gladly email it out.
Perhaps I'll try and get a copy off that. I'll see if I can post it up on TNS and the Scottish Sovereign site.
Oh, feel free, man. If you've got it on your email, Dr. Rock, post it up with my compliments. Yeah,
I'll do that.
And literally, there's a definition in there. I think it is. I think it's in that or it's in the main part. But basically, it effectively says, where are we? It words it that title deeds are not security. They're not defined as security when we're talking about general bank liens. Right, here we go. Yeah, as regards, here we go. Securities, as defined by Stroud Judicial Dictionary, 5th edition, 1986, It says, definition number three, as regards a banker's general lien, means such securities as promissory notes, bills of exchange, exchequer bills, coupons, bonds of foreign governments, but not title deeds. And the case there is Weald versus Radford, 33. So I don't know if that's 1933. But the point is this. On a mortgage, what is the actual security? Is it people's homes?
Or is it the bit of paper?
It's the bit of paper. And when they define on that bit of paper the security as, on the mortgage deed, this is the security, and they put your address down with a postcode, that doesn't exist. That's the matrix. That postcode does not exist. So what they're basically saying is the piece of paper that derives from the mortgage deed, which invokes the terms and conditions, which allows them to create the promissory note, that's the security, not your home. And that's why a lot of the guys up near Nottingham Way, a chap called Nick and Kevin and all the team up there that have decided to very much research mortgages in depth, that is why there is a case which states that if someone's coming to evict you, they cannot forcibly kick the door down. They cannot forcibly remove you. You have to abandon the property. And when you abandon it, you are gifting it to the mortgage company. That's a fact.
Yeah.
Right. Everything else, remember, everything else is calling your bluff. It's another play. And in that play, two connotations and two meanings of the word. A, they're bluffing you in the game of poker. Are you going to fold? Are you going to fold and walk away from the battlefield? That's the first play. The second play is everyone's got their part to play in the play and act their part. And so, of course, the way that the gangsters want you to act, the pirates, the way they want you to act is as the defenseless victim. And off you go. All right? But when you start asking the questions, the beautiful thing is that the old Buffy the Vampire thing comes into play, where vampires cannot stand the light being shone upon them. They can't stand it. And you start asking these questions, and make sure that you bring them back to these questions. Don't get diverted. Don't get distracted. Always bring them back, okay? Then literally, they cannot cope with it. They literally disintegrate.
Yeah.
All right? So, yeah. You know, anyone that wants this document, feel free.
What's your email address, Simon? I'll put it in so people can sign up to your newsletter as well.
Right. Okay. It's the it's whiterabbiteducation.
Yeah.
@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Because of the sheer volume of emails I get, it might take a few days for me to ping it back, but I'll happily ping it back. And if Dr. Rock's going to post this on the TNS website anyway, then you can certainly get the document as pertains unsecured credit, okay, which has gone up there. Utilize the third-party interaction, whether the trust relationship or a third party. Let's say that, you know, Auntie May said she's going to pay this all off now and wants to exchange it for the original document. Any games play you want to use of that nature where you bring in a third set of eyes works. Categorically, it works, right? If they don't then, you know, show up the original note, put the account into dispute. OFT leaflet, that's the Office of Fair Trading leaflet 664, clearly states once it's in dispute, the company cannot demand payment from you. It's in dispute, and it's in dispute because you're disputing it, period. If need be, let the ombudsman deal with it. Because my attitude is the ombudsman can keep it forever and a day. I don't care. As long as I'm not paying it, what do I care?
Yeah.
You know? And then if need be, if it gets to a period in time where you think, well, hold on, this has gone on long enough, I suspect foul play, and I can assure you there is foul play at work, then perhaps take the ball game to them and go over to their touchdown line and look for a potential criminal complaint. Or, excuse me, provide them with this document or your version of this document and say, well, I'm going to give you 14 days to either arrange for me to exchange XYZ, or I've got no alternative but to construe that there must be foul play, so I'm then going to file for a criminal prosecution and list the members of staff concerned. Send a copy to each member of staff, give them 14 days. And if need be, email your document, your statutory declaration, to your local magistrates. Because it's emailed, once they acknowledge receipt, there you go, it's in the record. They've acknowledged receipt. If a public servant doesn't want to process that, oh dear, misconduct in public office, we can start playing this game with them. We'll play them against their rules. Get in there and let's see if we can get some criminal prosecutions going. Okay, and I would love to see people around the country doing this en masse, because I think we need to send a message out, you know, that we're not going to be screwed about on this. And that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, as long as the banks put it in clear black and white on their advertisements, okay, as to how it works, then fine, I've got no problem with it. If they want to do that and people want to go with that, that's cool, as long as it's all clear up front. But the problem is they don't describe it clearly up front, because they pretty much, I would suspect that people would not want to do it to the extent that they do it at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a really fine recommendation, and hopefully you'll come back on when you've seen these people in the court and let us know how it went. So have you got what do you reckon? What are you hoping to achieve? Shall we say? What would be your ideal outcome from next week's meeting?
Well, I'm hoping that the judge, and in fact, I've got a funny anecdote if you've got time. I'm hoping that the judge is going to agree to reopen up the bankruptcy and get them to sort it out administratively, which means that they can keep it in-house and nice and quiet.
Yeah.
That's their back door. That's the back door I've given them, right?
Yeah.
That's the only back door they've got, because otherwise it's just going to go absolutely ballistic, because I'm just going to scream this from the rooftops as far as I'm concerned.
And it does seem to me that you quite often do get a better result, or you might even get a result by keeping it in the private rather than moving it into the public, as it were.
Well, you've got to remember, it is in the private. When we go into court, that is a private venue. It's not public. What they don't want is having it made public.
That's
so
right.
Therefore, one of your key weapons is to make it public. And I found that on any of my documents where I say, right, you know, all communications past, present and future are now going to be made available to the public. And I even then, you know, actually say to them, hey, look, you know, why don't you check out this link? I've put it up online. I'm naming you.
Yeah.
Or when I phone people, I actually say to them, if they get a bit funny with me, I just say, well, you know, hey, we're broadcasting live across the internet. Any further comments? You know, and they just get stumped. They really do. So I think we have to start really calling their bluff. Let's play this poker game back at them. But one funny thing that's happened, the judge that kind of declared me bankrupt, who obviously is aware that I'm going to be back in there and I'm going to be seeing him next Friday, he was handling a totally different case for me a couple of weeks back. I'd received a mail shot, one of my admin fees. I was in court and walked in there and he fought my case for me.
Right.
Which I found quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing that that Guy Taylor's noticed as well, is that the functionaries, as he calls them, are starting to come round to our way of thinking. They're starting to see a lot more cooperation and useful behaviour as opposed to just obstructionism, basically.
I think so. And I think, you know, it's got to come down to, without wanting it to sound like some kind of Hollywood production or anything, you know, I think, you know, on one level, you have to show that you are prepared to go the whole way. And I mean the whole way, no matter what it means, that you are prepared to stand there and, for one, without trying to sound like some heroic, you know, swashbuckler or something, but even to the point of, if you guys are going to have to kill me to shut me up.
Yeah.
Period. Yeah. You're going to have to kill me. Now, I said this.
They're going to be killing us if we keep shut up anyway.
Well, exactly. So what have we got to lose? So, I mean, I said this to two members of staff, one at Sainsbury's Bank, one at HBOS. The girl at HBOS just said to me, don't be so ridiculous. And I said, well, hold on a second. You know, you guys have got no qualms about killing people in foreign countries by funding wars. You know, you've killed millions. I'm just one guy, so you've got no qualms about killing me. So go ahead. She was in tears at the end of that.
Yeah.
Not from me abusing her, but I think she got upset by the thought that maybe she was working for an institution that was killing people. And Sainsbury's Bank didn't want to take me up on the offer. Well, not yet, anyway. So, you know, I guess the only other top tip, and I know I do talk a lot, but the only other top tip that I've got is that it would appear from the Consumer Credit Act 2006, right? I've got this here. If anyone's thinking of taking out a loan or credit card, right, just bear this in mind. Or even a mortgage, right? Bear this in mind. A, any kind of contract you're looking to take out, make sure you include your terms and conditions on your paperwork. Because the other party always tells you what their terms and conditions are. We never tell them what our terms and conditions are. So it's important that you create your own terms and conditions, maybe including the caveat of things like fees, admin fees, so on and so forth, but also including something along the lines of, you know, you agree to all these and you'll demonstrate your agreement by getting into business with me. So the moment they get into business with you, that's it. Your terms and conditions now apply, right? However, if it's to do with credit or something of this nature, what you must do, what I would recommend, is apart from signing it with maybe the three dots top left, three dots bottom right, is also to actually then start demanding every 6 months you send them a statement of account for the note that they owe you back. Because the Consumer Credit Act 2006 actually has this wording. Let me find it here. Where are we? I think it was on this one. It was either this or the Consumer Protection Act 19. I can't remember what it was now. But anyway, I had this sent to me by another trusted bunny. And basically the wording goes along the lines of, yeah, Consumer Protection Act 1987. It's basically saying that if a creditor doesn't want repayment, if there's nothing outstanding to a creditor, then we require or that you don't send any statements out to the debtor. Now, what do we never send the bank when we've taken out a loan or credit card? We never send them a statement of account.
No.
So every 6 months, anyone taking out new credit cards and this, that, and the other, okay, I've got some sample terms and conditions. It's only my sample. All right, so I know I've emailed this out to quite a few people. So, you know, again, if you want those, email me. It might take a while coming back, but I'll gladly email them to you. You can add your bits and pieces to those. But make sure that you, every 6 months, send them a statement of account, because it's all about your intentions and your actions, and you make sure you put on there the face value of the note. If it's a credit card, you put on that statement the value, the face value of the note, the credit limit, that is, but you also put the total value of all transactions you've passed through that account for that 6 months. Because with every transaction, there's a credit and a debit, and they owe you the credit back because you created it. So you put that on a statement, and you make sure you send that out every 6 months. So you'd have to do a bit of admin work, but it could actually come back to save you and make your life a hell of a lot easier if it comes down to any kind of argument or dispute or controversy. Yeah. All right, that's just top tip.
Brilliant. We've got there's a message from Jason M for you in the chat box. It says, "Beware Southend County Court. They're so corrupt. My friend is an ex-court manager, and he has seen the light. He was winning a case for someone, so next day 15 coppers stopped him entering the court. Judge railroaded the other guy in his absence. Now it's going to a high court, but..."
Yeah, I know about Southend County Court. I mean, apparently I'm a minor celebrity down there, and I think I'm still barred from Southend and Basildon courts. Obviously, they gave me a 1-year civil restraining order, but I'm also barred from the courts anyway because I upset some of the staff. But the funny thing is, down at Southend, the security guards down there, they're good fellas. They said I was the politest and easiest ejection from a court they'd ever had to put into effect. And you know, they know me when I go in there. They know who I am. They recognize me. The court ushers, Karen and Tim, hello to you two out there if you're listening. And you know, they're quite friendly. And the fact of the matter is, when we're actually educating people and when we start raising these questions, the way that we look at these people in their eyes is going to change.
People know.
You know, if I had someone looking at me and I thought that they didn't believe what I was saying, you can pick up on that, right? You can pick up if they don't believe you. So what do you think these court staff and bank staff and everything else and judges, when you're looking at them and you're looking at them in that way, sending that energy and that vibe to them that you know they're lying, eventually, you know, this is going to break these people down because they do have consciences. They might be well hidden, but they still have consciences. And one thing they all rely on is the respect that people give to them. You start taking that respect away, and I don't mean being obnoxious and swearing and stuff like that. I mean just in the general, the way that you look at these people, when they start losing that respect, I think you'll find there's going to be quite a few people maybe leaving the service. And I know that I think it was 2 years back, I think there were quite a few magistrates had resigned in the first 6 months of that year, 2 years back or whatever. So I think, you know, people out there that are putting into place some of this paperwork, no matter how you express it, you're doing a great job because you're waking these people up and you're showing them that they are working for dodgy companies.
Yeah. And the more of us that are doing it, the more people are going to see the stuff. Plus the fact that it is now so obvious that out of the corner of everybody's eye, it must be starting to become apparent.
Yeah, absolutely. And now that that's happening, it will. It's just a virus. It's Independence Day virus, you know. These people are not going to be able to look themselves in the mirror. And, of course, you know, who's going to want to go down? I've got no doubt that a lot of people went out, and if they were asked what they did, oh, yes, I'm a judge. Who's going to want to admit to being a judge nowadays?
That's absolutely true. Well, look, we're coming up to the end of another show. It's now 9:15, so Freeman Jack will be on after Dr. Rock. Thanks very much for your time, Simon. I can tell by the chat box that people have been listening and enjoying that, and obviously you're welcome back anytime.
Cool. Well, I'll be back after the events of next week, and I'll wait and see what happens then, and I'll certainly ping you a message anyway, Dr. Rock, and let you know what happened. And if it proceeds to criminal, then we'll soon find out what happened. But please, people out there, keep an eye on the YouTube channel. I'm going to do my utmost to get some revealing conversations on there, and once I get hold of a spy cam, oh God help people.
As I say, the White Rabbit Education vids are most entertaining and really beautifully musically accompanied as well, in my opinion, for what that's worth. And like I say, I especially recommend the seminars for anybody who can get to them. And to get those, you can write to whiterabbiteducation@gmail.com and ask to be put on their mailing list, and that gets you not only notice of seminars and things, but also references to useful documents that Simon's come across as he's been going about his various businesses. So I thoroughly enjoyed that, Simon. It's always a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Cheers, man. Thanks for having me on.
I'll see you again soon. I think Freeman Jack, who's currently streaming, will put on a tune for us right now. I will then regain control of the helm and come back to you with a few closing comments. Thanks to everybody for being out there as well. Thank you, Simon. We'll hand the stream over for a moment.
No worries.
So Simon Spaniard emphasising for us once again just exactly how illegal and fraudulent the entire banking system is, concentrating mostly on the theft of negotiable instruments through fraud and misrepresentation. So not only are they doing that, of course, fractional reservation of funds, make sure they get ten times as much as any money we actually put in there. They don't publish the interest, so they have to take it off people in kind of goods and services, and even that's not enough. They actually have to then fix the interest rates as well. And it's not just LIBOR, there are an astonishing network of different interest rates applied across all sorts of commodities and monies, and every single one of them is usury, and every single one of them is being manipulated. They are, as we heard Simon mention, laundering the proceeds of criminal activities such as drug smuggling, some of them, concealing the income of foreign nationals, some of them, mis-selling personal pensions, nearly all of them, endowment mortgages, split capital investment trusts, and most recently payment protection insurance. And that's still not enough, it seems. Still, they have to run off with your promissory notes as well. And all of those things, personal pensions, endowment mortgages, split capital investment trusts, were almost entirely a rip-off. And they weren't just sold by the banks. I remember every single one of those, partly, of course, because of my reading a private eye, but also because I remember them in the papers. I remember everybody proclaiming this miracle and then that miracle and then another miracle, and every single one of them was a rip-off. It may be that one or two people managed to make a bit out of them, but nothing like the banks were making. Fraud, theft and deception, a la carte. Free personal banking. How may we seem to help you whilst robbing you blind? It's absolutely shocking. And whilst accepting, obviously, in this complicated world, it is extremely difficult for some people to do without a bank account altogether. It's difficult to do without one under almost any circumstances, but we are dealing with criminals. Simon made it quite clear, it is fraud, it is theft, and we're complicit. That's my comment, not Simon's. And the PPI thing, a lot of us are getting these phone calls just coming through from robots telling us that we're owed so much on a credit card and all the rest of it. And according to Private Eye, which has done not only a good summary of the general state of play of personal payment insurance, it's also listed, which I won't have time to go even look at the top ones of, but it's listed all the people who are in charge of all of the banks that are involved in what I'm about to talk about, and every single one of them is now working in financial regulation or still in the banks, further up the banking, but quite a lot of them are actually in the regulation of the system that did all of these different mis-selling. That is such a piece of misdirection. It wasn't mis-selling at all. They knew exactly what they were doing. Between the 90s and 2010, some 20 million consumers were sold policies that were more often than not ineligible to cover loans, mortgages and credit cards. Once the credit boom started in 2001, it rose to an estimated £34 billion worth of these policies were sold by banks, by building societies, by credit card companies and other unspecified lenders. Personal payment insurance policies carry as much as a 90% profit margin, and compensation paid since 2011 has been £7.5 billion. Yet this is a massive financial crime, seemingly without criminals. Customers have been robbed and shareholders have been stuffed because it's the shareholders that pay the fines. But there have been no criminal charges of fraud, deception or theft against any of those who peddled PPI. No director from a major lender has been sacked. None has been banned or even disciplined by the FSA. Lloyds, who of course took over HBOS, Barclays, RBS, who took off Abbey National, Bradford and Bingley and the Alliance and Leicester, have made compensation provision to the tune of £11 billion. Hefty set-asides have also been made by the Nationwide and the Northern Rock and all three versions of Santander. Complaints about PPI that are admittedly being driven, as I said, by robots and profit-hungry claims companies are running at 100,000 a month. Now, 100,000 a month. Lloyds and RBS liabilities, for which the taxpayer, nominally as we know, but the taxpayer is nominally the biggest shareholder, so they'll become liable for that, and that's going to reach £15 billion, they reckon. So far, the Financial Services Authority, or the fundamentally supine authority, as Private Eye like to call it, which is, as Simon said, about to be disbanded, has extracted fines totalling £12.85 million against sales of £34 billion. This includes £49,000 and £10,500 respectively on the chief executive and a compliance director of two mortgage brokers. These are the only individuals to have been taken to task by the FSA for this massive, massive rip-off. I don't know. The latest FSA fine was recently levied against the seemingly ethical Co-op Bank for failing to handle 1,600 claims either fairly or quickly in 2011, which was when the bank's resistance to compensation finally evaporated. And we've heard on previous discussions about money and the like, quite often what comes up are the names of two banks, Triodos and Co-op, more or less arm in arm, as being the ethically preferred alternative. I don't really know much about Triodos, but it's quite clear that the co-op bank is not the same thing as the old cooperatives. And there you go, failing to serve 1,600 people properly. The biggest fine so far has been £7 million merely, and it was attracted by Alliance and Leicester. It had sold 211,000 policies worth £267 million in a mere 3 years. £7 million fine, £267 million worth of them sold. This is an interesting system. Private Eye sum it up by saying the regulatory response appears to be that compensation equals justice, that the guilty will pay, except that they don't. Compensation is paid by shareholders, not by those who profited from commissions and bonuses, and we might argue that ultimately it's not paid by the shareholders. And that goes all the way up into the executive suite. PPI profit margins could be up to 90%, and at its peak, around 2005, PPI may have represented more than 50% of UK retail banking profits. Bonuses from the branch and call centre level to the boardroom were driven by PPI incentives. So there, we've heard about small personal fraud that is being regularly executed by the banks pretty much across the piece. And there, we see the latest summary of what is a long string of extremely expensive rip-offs as far as the people are concerned. And of course, the real problem is not that we can't survive without bank accounts. The real problem is that we don't currently have an alternative. We know that those alternatives are out there. Mathematically perfected economy seems to be really getting its explanations together. There's some fantastic links and information out there, so we can start to see something that replaces it. But if most of us surely do not want to trade with these people, most of us surely would rather have whatever our money is or whatever it represents held in a fairer, equitable system, or at least one where we get to see as much profit out of it as they do. The problem is we don't have one. It really must be time to address that problem absolutely now, because the scale of the problems described by Simon Spaniard and by the PPI scandal and all the scandals that have gone before it should not. It's just impossible to imagine that we should continue to fail to do something about it. And if just getting your loan note back off them together, or not getting your loan note off them, getting a letter back saying, sorry mate, we burnt it, when that is quite clearly against their own legislation, then so be it. But I reckon, go get it. That's what I say. Regular listeners to the show will know that out of all the many tens or maybe hundreds of comics, papers, magazines and various other published entities that I've experienced during my life, all of them have fallen by the wayside as the years have gone by, with the exception of Private Eye, which I've read for some 30 years now, and whilst recognising that it's basically, in some senses, written by the prefects about the people they were at school with, they have obviously quite in-depth sources as to where their information comes from. The whole thing has become a lot more interesting for me in that now I've got the internet and can actually look up the kind of reports and acts and various other things that are being mentioned, have a look at the people that are being talked about and the rest, which means that I can get a lot more detailed. They spend a lot of time making sure their prose is extremely punchy and informative, and by and large there's not a spare bit of stuff on it. Well, I want to spend a bit of time thinking about an item that was in the most recent Private Eye, in their regular legal news section, which is always interesting. Sometimes it's a lot more interesting than others. And this particular one concerns a decision by the Ministry of Justice to scrap the, what we best call an allegedly independent watchdog. I always think that when you see the word independent, it probably means that it's not. Well, anyway, what is independent? They've decided to scrap the administrative watchdog, which is called the Administrative Justice and Tribunals Panel. And effectively, as Private Eye says, the Ministry of Justice has concluded that it can probably mark its own homework in future. The Tribunals Panel was established under the Tribunals Courts and Enforcement Act in 2007. And it's claimed by the relevant website that it was formed to keep the administrative justice system under review, and consider ways in which it can be made fairer, more accessible, and more efficient. Well, I'm pretty sure I've heard some fair ideas that way, and I wonder very much whether that's what this would actually achieve, but anyway, that's its stated aim. And it says that for these purposes, the administrative justice system means the overall system by which decisions of an administrative or executive nature are made in relation to particular persons, including the procedures for making such decisions, the law under which such decisions are made, and of most interest to me, the one that caught my eye was, it's also for checking out the systems for resolving disputes and airing grievances in relation to such decisions. So really, that applies to the whole thing, but we're aware, are we not, that the number of grievances are rising, not only because the system is thoroughly taking people for a ride, making sure the money that they've got in their pocket, such as it is worth less as time goes by, at the same time as taking more money off people and making various things as scarce as they properly can, as they can, really. And these systems for resolving disputes include employment tribunals, which we've had a couple of interviews about the Dr. Rock on. We know that quite often employment tribunals end up with so-called whistleblowers in front of them, and already these people are getting landed with huge charges and all the rest. So the employment tribunals are clearly already having something of a difficulty. It covers judicial reviews, and several people that are known on TMS have been trying judicial reviews and also finding that those are not necessarily always as beneficial or as beneficially executed as they might be. It also covers, alas, benefit claims and finally immigration appeals. So, employment, judicial questions, benefit claims and immigration appeals. Once again, I think it's clear that what we're seeing is going to have most effect on the people that we already know to be the poorest in society and the most disadvantaged, be it through resource, through language, through culture, any other kind of mean. All of these things are applicable. On the 18th of December 2012, the government laid before Parliament a draft order abolishing the Tribunals Council under the provisions of the Public Bodies Act 2011. It's only been in existence for 4 years, this particular body. 4 years before the bill was laid, the groundwork for its abolition. And the first thing I thought was, how can that possibly be an effective use of people? Presumably they were probably all somewhere else before they got moved into the Tribunals Council. I would imagine there were a lot of new chairs, new desks, new computers and all manner of other things set up for this. And I think it's possibly also pretty safe to assume that if you're going to put together a new and huge department that's going to cover the kind of subjects that were referred to in its definition, then it'll take a year or two for it to settle in, find its way and things. It is said that if you choose to go into business for yourself, you can expect to be working for the company, as it were, for a couple of years before the company starts working for you. And in my experience, that's true about most complex, multi-person, technologically-based systems. So for a start-off, it's going to be very difficult on the people and is probably going to involve a huge waste of infrastructure. And that doesn't include the amount of money that will have been poured in there, because once again, I think we can safely assume that the guys at the top will have been getting plenty of cash for doing this. It's quite possible, of course, that they'll get plenty of cash for not doing it as well. That's something that comes up in private eye a lot, that many people who turn out to be demonstrably and almost culpably useless at their job do tend to leave with an increased pension and several zeros in their pocket. Private Eye states that the Ministry of Justice optimistic projected savings of 4.6 million are dwarfed by the cost of running appeals tribunals that needn't happen if the justice system didn't cock things up in the first place. Private Eye is still catching up with the fact that it's all being done deliberately, but I'm sure it'll get there in the long run. It tends to go for a cock up rather than conspiracy, which of course is how we're all conditioned to think. Typically, of course, these kind of savings, these estimates of savings are always optimistic. And even if it's correct, 4.6 million is absolutely nothing in the greater scheme of things. Remember, people are talking in billions and trillions of dollars, as we'll hear when we get onto the banks a little later, especially given what's at stake. These kind of minimal savings are going to be to the huge disadvantage of large numbers of already hugely disadvantaged people. Estimates for savings, of course, traditionally bigger than the savings actually made, normally by quite a long chalk. And in fact, in many cases, costs actually rise simply as a result of making the kind of large-scale changes that we're talking about. Also, there will have to be costs associated with this particular change, which aren't mentioned in the article, but of course estimates of costs are typically smaller than the actuality. So one way or the other, once again, they get to cut the cake from both ends there. And I think it's important to remember that the loss of this particular body is following, you know, amongst many others, but the obvious ones are the loss of our courts de jure, the loss of our rights to a jury trial, even for reputedly going over a given limit of some sort or another. It used to be a very expensive and time-consuming business, and that remains our right, even though for some reason people seem to feel we should no longer have access to such things. We also heard from Guy Taylor, a couple of weeks back now, that we have also apparently somewhere along the way lost our right to a committal hearing, and they're primarily designed to look at any kind of evidence there might be to see whether it's necessary to bring the thing to court. And it is my shrewd suspicion that these kind of removals of basic rights, or at least they're hiding from us, are working just towards this kind of ratchet approach where we see ever more of the things that were supposedly at least working in our interest being removed in the name of costs, when in fact we can see that the changes that are being made are inevitably going to lead to large-scale increases in just the kind of appeal that are going to be disadvantaged here. The Tribunals Council has responded effectively to a call for evidence from the Communities and Local Government Select Committee, which is looking into the implementation of welfare reform by local authorities. So there you can see exactly what the target is. When I've finished working my way through this, I'll post the link into the chat boxes so that you can see the whole document. It's about 8 or 10 pages long and has a lot of interesting things in it, but I've just chosen to highlight the ones that I think are of particular interest to me, particularly following on from the Welfare Show with all the material that we get from that excellent show on a weekly basis. The Tribunal's Council's response basically reveals that it is concerned, unsurprisingly, about a number of aspects of the reform programme, including appeal rights, the impact of reform in Scotland and Wales, and the abolition of the Social Fund. The committee's inquiry, it says, would be enhanced by investigating the effect of welfare reform on associated appeal rights. So it sounds like they haven't actually been able to look too hard at the results of the primary aim of this particular manoeuvre. And they're particularly concerned about it because it raises particular questions as to the degree of consultation between the Department for Communities and Local Government and other relevant bodies, which is another tiny little phrase that we see quite often, other relevant bodies. And of course, once again, given the span, given the kind of scope of this body's job, which is to oversee effectively the entire legal administrative process, these people would have to be considering, at least on the terms we've been looking at so far, talking to employment bodies, immigration bodies, the judiciary, the benefits system, which nowadays includes the tax department, Lord help them, and there are many, many more. As soon as you start having a quick look at all of this, the Department for Communities and Local Government and local authorities have to deal with a lot of individual bodies, and one of the things that the Tribunals Council is concerned with is that they have not been able to even look at this, it would appear. There's evidence to suggest that the local government department has adopted an England-centric approach to the entire issue, notwithstanding the significant impacts of the localisation of welfare upon Scotland and Wales. So what they've done is they've designed whatever change it is they're making, as far as they design anything, in terms of the English regulations with regard to all of these matters. And these are devolved matters for the imitation governments in Scotland and Wales. As we're going to hear, the entire solution, even for England, is a complete lash-up. And to actually try and make it extend over Scotland and Wales when there doesn't appear to be any authority so to do seems to me to be, once again, quite extraordinary. And, of course, again, what we're seeing here is one hat to fit many heads, effectively. We're expecting the same thing to work all the way from John O'Groats down to Land's End and right the way across to North Wales and South Wales, all such different places. And they say that in particular, this local government department did not appear to acknowledge the difficulties which could arise from the removal of council tax support appeals from a tribunal operating across Great Britain to one whose operations are devolved in Scotland and Wales. Council tax is, of course, one of the areas that local government has really, through the diligent action of many, many individuals, been significantly painted into a corner. It's been pointed out, it was Guy Taylor, in fact, that pointed out that off the record, the court staff that he's been dealing with, I think it was in Hereford, is starting to own up to this, starting to realise that there isn't anywhere to go. This clawless is clearly going to make appeals even more difficult to manage than they have been so far, given that the council tax is itself such a shocking and demonstrable fraud, let alone the means that are being used to enforce it. What the tribunals in Wales and the committees in Scotland do share, however, is a lack of direct expertise in social welfare law, the area with which reduction scheme appeals will still be concerned. They also share an entirely lay membership, volunteers. By contrast, complicated social welfare law principles, which cases often raise, are presently dealt with by legally qualified judges, as supported by expert wing members. So, at least in the terms with which they're talking, they feel that there's a reasonable support system in place at the moment, which has informed and trained people at the top of it, who are at least capable, or qualified, if not capable, of making a legal determination. Whereas we're moving that over to an entirely lay membership, which will know little, I suspect, about what it's doing. And certainly will not have the kind of knowledge of the law which will allow them to make probably correct decisions, because one of the problems with all of this, of course, is that as things go more and more wrong, you get more and more appeals and have appeals on appeals and all the rest of it. And in various ways, the tribunal which will now hear council tax support cases is ill-suited to this role, according to the tribunal, a problem which the Local Government Finance Act 2012 implicitly recognises in relation to the English tribunals, but not to the Scottish or Welsh equivalents, because, of course, they're not being treated in any kind of detail at all. I would presume that the bit they're talking about there in that Local Finance Act is that the scheme must state the procedure by which a person can make an appeal against any decision of the authority which affects either the person's entitlement to a reduction under the scheme or the amount of any reduction to which the person is entitled. However, it's since become more apparent, according to the tribunal, that the rationale for the new change lies in the reconceptualizing of support for council tax liability. I suspect we could probably do half a show just on that phrase there. The rationale for the new change lies in reconceptualising support for council tax liability. Of course, even the liability itself is so hugely in question that that's a really sweeping statement. Anyway, moving on. In bringing forward the Local Government Finance Bill, the government no longer wished council tax support to be understood in terms of or to be administered as part of the GB-wide welfare benefits system. It instead wanted support to be understood and administered having regard to the discretion of local authorities to reduce liability according to criteria which they themselves should devise. Now that really does make my hair stand on end. The idea that, given all the difficulties we already face, that we're going to have to deal with local authorities defining their own little foibles and ways and means of doing things within this apparent overarching act is, well, I mean, again, I just refer to the welfare. You've only got to listen to the kind of difficulties that people have when they start communicating with the welfare authorities as called, even as it stands, and listen to the hugely complex requirements and needs and paperwork and questions and all the rest of it. But at least we can talk about it and know that we're all facing the same form. What's it going to be like if the people in Yorkshire are getting a different form from the people in London, are getting a different form from the people in Cardiff? It's going to make it presumably a little more difficult for us to manage what it is that's going on. The government response to this consultation, and again, we shouldn't be surprised, even that acknowledged that there were concerns that the number of appeals may increase. Well, yes, I should, Cokie. And that this could prove challenging because the variations of local schemes and the need for additional expertise on means testing within the valuation tribunal. So one of the things they're doing is introducing means testing for employment tribunals, which means that not only do you have to have the experience in everything else, you have to have experience in means testing as well. Even so, the government ultimately took the view that appeals on all matters to do with council tax should be dealt with by that tribunal. So in other words, they're saying that they're well aware that there's significant problems with this, but they think we should go ahead with it anyway. And the Tribunals Council had, and continues to have, serious misgivings about this, given the Valuation Tribunal judiciary's lack of expertise and experience in means testing and related welfare matters. Fancy dealing with some amateurs out there, folks, because it looks like that's what they have in mind. The abolition of the Office of the Social Fund Commissioner potentially poses risks for those currently eligible for social fund grants or loans. This is especially so given that there will not necessarily be any effective alternative means of challenging decisions under new local authority schemes. There will not necessarily be any effective alternative means of challenging decisions under new local authority schemes. So that's local authorities implementing reform face financial and resource-based impediments to preparing for their new responsibilities. So as well as all the stuff that's already outlined, the complexity, the lay members, the loss of qualified people, the fact that it's going to be varied across the whole of England, let alone between England, Scotland and Wales, and that all of this is acknowledged, it's also acknowledged that there's going to be financial and resource-based impediments. So, as we know, all of that's being cut as well. So, and this is even to prepare for their new responsibilities. There's another, what I thought was a careful piece of wording. Even to prepare for their responsibilities, these people are deemed to be under-resourced, and we can quite see how that is probably the case. In addition to this, the tribunal reckon, and this has got to be a fair comment under the circumstances, there is a risk of public ignorance, both of the reforms themselves and of their potential consequences, which is another fair point. It's going to be a lot more difficult for us to be able to guess what's going to happen next and prepare for it in any sense at all under a system such as this, if system is the word that could be applied, which it can't really. Interestingly, the response from the tribunal is dated 14th of December 2012. The abolishing order was drafted 4 days later on the 18th of December 2012. I'm not sure that we can draw any conclusions from that, but it does rather look like their response was a bit of a stick in a wasp's nest, and they are, whatever it is they're doing, it's not popular. And that, I'm sure, is coming as no surprise to any of you. And the timing, of course, is absolutely perfect. In April, we see cuts to legal aid, and that's going to mean more pointless and distressing cases that proper advice and investigation would forestall. But as the removal of committal hearings shows, and indeed the removal of courts de jure, proper advice and investigation are not what these people are interested in. If they were interested in looking at the evidence, or if it was going to be of any significance at all, then these things would not be happening. And as well as the cuts to legal aid that are due in April, in the summer we get to see introduction of fees and therefore means testing, as I said, for employment tribunals. So from that point, that also becomes hugely, hugely complicated. And we also have seen, as the months have gone by, that the size of forms have gone from kind of 1 to 2 to 4 to 20 pages. And I'm sure that the means testing is not only inconvenient and time consuming, but it will also involve surrendering massive amounts of data to people who I'm not sure we want to have that information. Private Eye sums it all up by saying by the end of the summer, the independent watchdog will no longer be around. So if, as suspected, the Ministry of Justice doesn't have the manpower to cope with the reforms, at least it won't have to put up with the Administrative Justice and Tribunals panel pointing out its shortcomings.